Hello, this is Brian Auten of Apologetics 315. Today's interview is with Graham Veal. Graham is the head of the Religious Education Department at the City of Armagh High School, Armagh, Northern Ireland, and he co-founded saintsandskeptics.org, a web ministry for apologetics. He is also the author of New Atheism, A Survival Guide. The purpose of today's interview is to talk about some of the popular objections and tactics of the new atheists. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast today, Graham.
Oh, thank you, Brian. It's very good to be here.
Graham, this time I'm interviewing someone not only in the same time zone, but in the same country. So tell our listeners a bit about yourself and where you're from.
Well, I'm from Armagh, which seems to be in a time zone all of its own, really. Armagh's officially the ecclesiastical capital of Ireland. And St. Patrick is buried in one of the cathedrals in Armagh, although St. Patrick seems to be buried just about everywhere in Ireland. But Armagh is claimed to St. Patrick's body. So I'm a religious studies teacher in City of Armagh High School. I'm responsible for teaching kids between the age of 11 to 16. So that keeps me relatively busy throughout the year, summer months excluded. I take my summer off. I'm also doing a little bit of postgraduate study at the Irish Baptist College on philosophy of religion. And I'll see where that takes me. But that's basically me summed up. Nothing spectacular. But I certainly enjoy teaching. I mean, that would be what I was, I love first and foremost, really. I mean, I think it's a fantastic job. It's a fantastic career. I'd thoroughly recommend it to anybody.
Well, tell our listeners just a bit about the religious education studies in Northern Ireland, because it's a little bit different than, say, some of our listeners who are in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, the religious studies is part of is legally you're bound to teach religious studies in Northern Ireland. And in a way, it's the churches have a lot of input still within the Northern Irish curriculum. So it's really based around Christianity. Now, I suppose the difference between what I would do, for example, in the book we're going to talk about in Saints and Skeptics and in schools, is that in a school, I am really there not to try to persuade somebody of the Christian worldview is true. You know, that's not really my job description as such. What I am there to do, though, is to present the Christian worldview and allow students to develop and defend their own beliefs about it. So, I'm not there, I'm not paid to convert people, but what we do is we compare, you would take the Christian worldview, you would look at the story of the Bible. So you spend a good bit of time with the Bible. I would have a look at philosophical issues, but, really the big philosophical issues in philosophy of religion are all covered in the GCSE course I do, like, miracles, revelation, rationality, belief in God, problem of evil, the relationship between Christianity and science, they're all covered. And what we do is we compare Christianity to a secular view and another religious view. So you're getting students to think through what Christianity is about and what it is rational to believe about it, and asking them to compare that to a secular point of view. And the student, I'm often asked, can a student in your class, if they're an atheist, do they get marked down? And some of my best students have been atheists, because like arguing. GCSE religious studies is basically GCSE debate, opinions, but it's also getting people thoroughly grounded in at least one religious worldview, which is Christianity, and comparing that to the secularism around us. And so long as a student can defend and can debate their ideas, you get the grades. But I think secularists and Christians should both be very happy with actually what happened, what aims to happen in Northern Ireland. Certainly in my classroom, I think my students now would be, whatever their religious views, would be very comfortable there. Because, you're allowed to express your ideas, you're allowed to defend your ideas. It's fairly rigorous. And But again, it's done in such a way, though, that somebody who is from a Christian background would feel very comfortable too, because so much time is spent in the Bible, so much time is spent explaining Christian doctrine and Christian beliefs, and they're taken seriously. You know, these are not taught as, you know, what people used to believe, or, you know, these are, or ideas that really aren't important to Christianity, or things that can be demythologized. You know, they're taught in a you know, that this is what Orthodox Christian belief is, and it's something that needs to be taken seriously, and you need to think this through. So that's really religious studies in Northern Ireland. The hostility towards religious studies in some countries in state schools, I don't quite understand. And I think it's maybe to the detriment of many students that religious studies isn't in their high school curriculum in countries abroad. I don't think that that necessarily expands minds in the way that they need to be expanded, particularly given the fact of religious pluralism. It's not going to go away. We live in religiously plural societies and cultures. That's not going anywhere. So I think that if students aren't taught how to debate and how to assess their own point of view on these critical issues and on the most fundamental issues, then I think those students are going to be in trouble. So that's my sales pitch for religious studies.
Well, very interesting stuff. And now you're talking about your day job there, but on the side, you run with David Glass, who's also from Northern Ireland here. You run the Saints and Skeptics website. Where is it? What is it? And what will readers find there? And I want to remind people that it's Skeptics with a C and not a K.
Yes, it's British / Irish Skeptics. Saintsandskeptics.org, Skeptics with a C. Saints and Skeptics was started up by David and myself. Oh, it's been in the pipeline for a long time. At the minute, it's mainly an online ministry, although we do go into churches and do talks or young people's groups and seminars. Really, wherever we're asked to go, we will go. It was started by David Glass and myself. There's two or three others coming on board. There's Rachel, Peter Morrow, Mark McCartney. We're starting to get a little group together now. It's an online web ministry, and really what we're trying to do is to address, to answer difficult questions. When that's what we see apologetics as. Apologetics is simply giving a reasonable, reasoned answer to a challenging question. And so really what we're trying to do in the Saints and Skeptics website is to provide answers on a variety of levels, you know, on the level that you would find on the street. But also articles that, you know, that a high school student can read, articles that, you know, a university student can read, or, you know, there's a variety of levels there and varying levels of depth in those articles for people to look around. I suppose most of our fire at the minute is really aimed at secularism and the argument's really coming from what we'd call the atheist movement, the artists formerly known as New Atheists. So really we respond to them mostly at the minute. We're trying to broaden that a bit, but also to look at the rationality of Christian beliefs, you know, for example, like the belief in hell or the need for salvation. So we're trying to provide articles, you know, we update weekly. And the trial provides articles which, you know, sometimes are just a series of quick thoughts that people can take and look through and, you know, be fairly brief responses to people. And then there's more in-depth articles as well. You know, we try to pick David's brain quite a bit, Mark's brain quite a bit, to try and get, you know, some good information out there on science and Christianity. And also to look at Christianity and the wider culture, and to respond to the questions that come to us. I mean, at the minute, one of the questions we keep having to come back to is the question of Christians and marriage, or defending the Christian view of marriage as between a man and a woman, which isn't something that we set out to do. You know, it wasn't something that we felt was particularly important when we set the site up, but it comes up so often in conversation, it comes up so often online, that we felt that some sort of response needed to be made there. So there, you know, there's a number of issues, or a number of articles on that issue. So if something is a live issue and it's out there, then we will respond to it and we'll try to give Christians something to say in conversation.
Well, very good. It's a great website. I want to recommend people visit it, and there's a lot of good resources there. We're going to be talking about your book today, Atheism, A Survival Guide. Atheism, A Survival Guide. Now, the new atheism is not so new, but its impact is being felt. And you mentioned some of the influences in the religious education class. But how do you think the new atheism has influenced the UK?
I think what the new atheism has established, although I think, as I mentioned earlier, they tend to refer to themselves as the atheist movement now because they're not so new anymore. But I think that they have established a fairly vocal voice for atheists in the public square, and a fairly vociferous voice as well. As far as the United Kingdom goes, I think they have almost created a culture where atheism is now just assumed as the default rational position. You know, atheism is just what the journalist on the street assumes is true and does not feel that they need to provide any argument for. I mean, I think that this is what's quite interesting now, is that people who are atheists, you know, journalists like Nick Cohen, guys like that, just seem to assume that atheism is something that does not need to be defended, you don't need any argument for it. I think that online their presence has been very influential. I think that they very quickly, and before a lot of other groups cottoned onto this, that they understood the power of the meme. The very simple, short, snappy idea, something that you could fit into 140 characters. And they understood that simple, short, sharp messages were the way to go. And because of that, you get some arguments that are very, very difficult to get out of people's heads. You know, people saying, for example, that atheism isn't a position, atheism isn't a belief, therefore they don't need to defend it. Which is, you know, it's total nonsense, because immediately you ask the question, well, is, you know, do you believe atheism is true or do you believe it's rational to be atheist? They have to have some sort of belief policy here to justify their atheism. But people don't seem to feel the need or don't seem to see that this is a position that they need to defend. So I think they've been very influential through the internet, and I think in popular culture, they have been influential in that atheism now can be seen as the default position. Now, why so? I think a mistake that a number of apologists make, and some quite well-known apologists, they tend to look at somebody like Richard Dawkins and say, well, he's embarrassed himself a lot on Twitter, or he's so vociferous and rude, people don't want to be associated with him. And people say things like, you know, well, new atheism is it's a known goal for atheism. The new atheism has made atheism less popular than it was before. Now, my first problem with that is there's zero evidence that I can see that atheism is becoming less popular at all. Never mind because of the new atheism. And secondly, Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss and guys like this are very savvy. And they understand that if they sound dogmatic and rabid and you know, vociferous or whatever way you want to describe them, the more argumentative and unreasonable and just, you know, cussed they sound, the more reasonable an atheist who just wants to dismiss Christianity quietly but doesn't really mind if the parish priest has his own blind irrational faith, they make that guy sound like a paragon of reason. So a journalist writing now who just assumes that atheism's true, assumes that atheism is the default rational position, doesn't argue for that, but doesn't sound as if he wants to hound Christians out of Britain altogether, or doesn't sound as if he wants to shout and rant and rave every time a religion's mentioned. That guy sounds just like a paragon of reason, a perfectly reasonable guy. And I think Dawkins creates room for this blind, unblinking, unthinking, dogmatic atheism that just really pervades our culture. Just so long as you're polite about your atheism now, you don't seem to need to think about it anymore. And so I think we underestimate the atheist movement or the new atheism at our peril. And I do think Christians are starting to do this now. And people that I would respect a lot saying things like, you know, new atheism's had its day. Where's your evidence for that? I'm certainly not encountering that at all.
That's a real good perspective, Graham. And, you know, we're talking sort of about the popular influence of atheism, maybe in the culture at large. How do you see it back to your role as an educator with younger people? I don't know the full length of the time you've been teaching, but have you seen much change in the sort of arguments that kids are bringing about or beliefs that they're holding?
Oh, well, you did at around about the stage of right about the time the God Delusion came out, I did notice. I've been teaching about 16 years now. Round about the stage of the God Delusion, I remember a student who was an atheist, and, you know, atheist stroke agnostic, and could argue fairly well for his point of view. Now, I mean, you've got to remember, these kids are 15, 16. You're not going to hammer them down. You have to let them, you know, to develop their ideas. And he just on the board one day, he was wiping the board clean for me. He just wrote up for what he thought a joke at the corner. He said, Darwin was right. And I says, what do you mean by that? And he said, oh, you know, Darwin was right. You know, the Bible's wrong. Christianity's not true. Atheism's true. I was just putting that on your board for a joke. He says, Michael, do you know anything about Darwin? You know, how do you make this leap from Darwin was right to Christianity's false? Do you know anything about evil? Hadn't a clue. But the slogans and the ideas were out there, and he was picking up on them. I think from that point on, I mean, I have noticed, you know, in recent years, the kids as young as 15, 16 are starting to pick up and make precisely the same arguments that quite often I'll hear very well-educated postdoctoral students or, you know, guys who maybe even lecture on a university level are making the same arguments as 15, 16-year-olds because of the internet. Our assumption tends to be that if somebody has shown a high degree of education in one area, therefore they are highly intelligent and competent in all areas. Now, I mean, in my experience, that's simply not true, because I have students at the age of 15 referring to, you know, arguments from the Flying Spaghetti Monster, or saying atheism isn't a belief, or they're picking these arguments up from online discussions, and guys who consider themselves to be much more educated, much more intelligent, much more rational, are making precisely the same arguments on Twitter and on Facebook. And, you know, sometimes you do feel like saying, yes, you know, I came across this argument the other day from a 15-year-old. But, I mean, the interesting thing is here is that the people are making the same arguments, are thinking the same way, you know, no matter what their level of education. And I think this means that, you know, new atheism is getting its message out there. It is entering the consciousness of young people. You know, it's not that difficult to deal with. You know, these arguments are fairly easy to deal with. And usually whenever I've discussed them with students for a while, they move on to something more substantial. But it is there, and I think trying to sweep the problem under the carpet, which seems to be the church's, you know, response to date, isn't the best way to go. And to clarify that, the statement, Dawkins is a very rude man who's had his day, that's sweeping the problem under the carpet. You know, you've got to look at these arguments head on and deal with them and deal with what he's saying and try to work out why this appeals to people.
Yeah, good points there, Graham. You know, one thought what I had when I was preparing for this interview is, will people want to listen to an interview about the new atheism? Will they think that this is old? You know, they've seen a lot of books that critique the new atheism, some really good, some so-so, just kind of riding the wave, maybe. But what led you to write your own book? I mean, obviously we see good reason to see that new atheism isn't dead. But what approach do you take, and what led you to write your own?
My book was initially entitled Mick Atheism, and my publishers felt that most people wouldn't pick up on what I was trying to get at, and I think they were right. But my book really isn't written as a response to The God Delusion or to Sam Harris's books or Christopher Hitchens' books. My book's really responding to the arguments that you'll encounter online. So I'll spend much more time talking about the flying spaghetti monster than I will do about, you know, the God delusion. So that's where I felt that something needed to be written, something that deals with the arguments of the atheist movement as a whole and these internet memes that are out there. I think that's where New Atheism, if you like, lives on. I think as a publishing sensation, I think that everybody who would buy a New Atheist book has now bought one. The interesting thing is they keep going back and buying more. You know, Sam Harris, Lawrence Krauss, these guys, you know, there's a market there that people will tap into and that authors and writers will want to use to sell books. So New Atheism isn't really going anywhere. As I said, they might start calling themselves an atheist movement. But the reason that I wanted to write the book is I felt that, you know, to a large extent, I think most of the books that were out there attacked the books of the New Atheism and didn't spend an awful lot of time attacking the arguments as they appeared online. The book's also really just an essay in defense of the Christian faith. It's only about 25,000 words. It's not a long book. I felt that, something in between the more academic tome that David Glass wrote, Atheism's New Clothes. And then there are other short books by David Robertson and guys like that. But I wanted something that a person could pick down and read, who isn't particularly into theology, isn't particularly into philosophy, but that was drawing on the best philosophy of religion out there, that was drawing on guys like Richard Swinburne or Paul Moser, you know, that was really trying to bring their arguments, you know, down to a level that a student or anybody can understand. And just in that, to just really provide what's just an essay in defense of the Christian faith, looking at what's a good explanation and why do we use explanations, and to try and present that in a lighter way. And I think New Atheism does give us an opportunity to maybe talk to people about Christianity who maybe wouldn't have wanted to talk about it before. You know, I mean, it creates a neutral ground where people who are, you know, who wouldn't necessarily attend a church might go to a church meeting to hear about Richard Dawkins, or might have a conversation with you about the New Atheism, but might be slightly uncomfortable if you came directly towards them with the gospel. So there's the New Atheism actually does create a bit of an opportunity for us here to talk to people about our faith.
Well, talking about the book itself, it's really well written, and you mentioned something that's readable, and I've read my share of New Atheist books. Some of them are highly philosophical, some of them are a little bit dry, some of them, you know, you just can't read them, but yours, you know, it kept drawing me in. I didn't have time to read a large chunk, you know, but it was like, you know, kept wanting to read. So I would encourage people, this is really a book that you can enjoy reading. Now, you mentioned addressing some of the different arguments. What ones do you address in the book, if you want to list a few, or sort of the range of things that you cover?
Right, I cover the flying spaghetti monster. And I think hilarious, actually, there's a chap who's come on the Amazon to review my book and has said that I misrepresent the flying spaghetti monster. I don't know how you misrepresent the spaghetti monster, but apparently I did it. Flying spaghetti monster is basically it's a pseudo-religion or a mock religion where people say, well, you know, my faith should be given equal status to your faith because I believe in a flying spaghetti monster. I don't have any evidence for my religion, but you don't have any for yours either. The idea is that belief in God is on a par with a flying spaghetti monster. And if anybody wants to accuse me of misrepresenting the flying spaghetti monster, if you go to the Veganza site, which is the flying spaghetti monster site, Richard Dawkins there has an article quoted with approval in which he basically says this is just an update of the, you know, the Bertrand Russell's flying teapot or orbiting teapot. The idea is that if you don't have you know, I could say that there's a teapot out there orbiting around the moon. You can't prove there's not, therefore I can believe in it. And that's the sort of the caricature of Christian faith, or any sort of faith. Faith is just something that you believe blindly. And my book addresses that and looks at and says, no, this is not what the Christian faith is. It's meant, you know, it connects with the real world. It's meant to explain things in the real world. And theism in particular works very well as an explanation of design, of morality. I think of our experiences to some extent, of our desires, and I also spend a bit of time looking at the evidence for the resurrection. But the Flying Spaghetti Monster, I spend a bit of time talking about it and comparing it to the Loch Ness Monster and other things that we don't believe in, and why these things aren't good explanations, and comparing them to good explanations. I also deal with the idea that science is somehow at odds with God. This seems to be something that the atheist movement is quite big on. It's trying to say, well, you know, science has somehow got rid of God in some way. And I spend a bit of time looking at why science and religion simply, and science and Christianity simply don't conflict. Particularly this idea that somehow, because as science has progressed, it's provided explanations of the world around us. As science provides more and more and more in terms of explanation of the physical world, the idea is there's less and less for God to do, God of the gaps, if you like. And this argument to me, it's absurd, because the first scientists were guys who said, well, if Christianity is true, then there's a God who would have made this world to function according to laws, so we should look for laws of nature. And just like a good clockmaker or a good engineer would use mechanisms, God would use mechanisms, so we should look for mechanisms in nature. But we also have to remember that if there is a God, we're not him. We're not God. We're not omniscient. We can't sit like the Greek philosophers in our armchairs and work out what the world's like. We've got to go and investigate our ideas and test our ideas, because God could have made the world in any one of a huge number of ways. We've got to go and test to see what he actually did. Those were all very Christian ideas, which are really important to the birth of modern science. And these guys started the whole process of science looking for laws and mechanisms because they believed in God. So if we find lots of laws and mechanisms that explain nature, well, then that should confirm our belief in God. Yet somehow this idea got out there that science somehow gets rid of God, and instead of looking at the success of science as confirming the truth of theism, people seem to have got this idea that somehow it robs us of the need of God as an explanation, which just strikes me as completely absurd. You know, people went looking for laws of nature. They went looking for physical mechanisms that could be understood by the human mind, and that could be understood using mathematics, because they believed there was a rational creator and that we were rational too, and we had been created by him, and therefore we could understand this world. But we needed to test our ideas because, you know, we're not God, and we're sinful, and we're fallen, and we're limited. So the success of science is a strikingly good argument for theism, and Christian theism in particular. Somehow out there in the world of the tweet, people seem to have got the idea that this is a very good argument against Christianity. That seems to be nonsensical.
Well, very good. I'll allow our readers to delve into the rest of the things that you address in the book. But one thing I wanted to ask you about is, how would you describe the rhetorical strategy used by the New Atheist? Do you think that it presents a challenge apart from their arguments? And maybe how should Christians respond? I know I've asked like three questions in a row there, but the idea behind this is, you mentioned, say, memes, and to take apart all kinds of different facets of the errors that you find in a meme takes a lot of time. But can Christians really respond in a similar fashion, or should we think about that? How do you go about looking at that?
Yeah, I mean, in the book I refer to this as sneer pressure. And the idea is that if somebody very clever and very opinionated is talking down to you, you feel a pressure to give in. And I think the first thing that people need to realize and the Christians need to realize is that, you know, very intelligent people can make very foolish statements and history's littered with them. In terms of responding to, for example, new atheist tweets, I think the two proverbs, you know, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he become wise in his own eyes, or or don't answer a fool according to his folly, in case he becomes wise in his, when to reply and when not to reply is a tricky thing. If you do want to reply to a new atheist tweet, say, you know, a quick meme, I think the best way to do it is to have a very quick question that you can put to that person and then insist that they answer. So, I mean, a guy on Twitter had a go at, you know, us in Saints and Skeptics recently, because he said, you know, atheism isn't a belief. You can't criticize my atheism. There's no such thing as an atheistic system of belief. Atheism isn't a belief. It's not a belief in anything. It's not a worldview. To which I immediately started asking questions. Like, okay, so is it always irrational to believe in God? You know, can I be rational and believe in God? And kept asking him questions like that. And he kept getting more and more irate and simply repeating his point. But the point is to push them back with a question where you know that he has to have a belief policy. He has to have a whole host of beliefs that are affected by his lack of belief in God. And if you keep pushing and pushing and pushing with questions on the weak point, you can try and provoke a sensible response. So that's one way to respond, is with a question rather than making a point of your own. Ask questions. But there is an article that we have on the Saints and Skeptics website called The McGowan's Test. And I would encourage people to read that article, The McGowan's Test, because it's a test that we apply quite a bit and it works quite well. Basically, McGowan's is a chatbot that just insults people. You know, it just throws back crude insults at people. And no matter what you say to McGowan's, it will throw back a line, you know, that's the most stupid, idiotic statement I've heard in my life. And incredibly, people will argue with McGowan's for hours, thinking they're arguing with a real person, and try to convince it that they're rational and they're sensible. And from that, I think what we have to learn here is if you get into a situation online or in conversation where you feel like you're arguing with a chatbot, you know, like, you know, it's like having a debate with Siri. You know, they're just throwing back one line to you. They're not thinking. They're just throwing back an insult. They're throwing back a meme. And you're not really engaging with somebody who's thinking. You're just engaging with rehearsed lines. Usually at that stage, I think you back off, you back away, you don't engage, because all you're going to do is make this person more and more irate. You know, unless you can build some sort of relationship with that person on other grounds, you're not going to get very far. So that's really where I feel that, you know, the rhetoric just needs to be ignored at that stage. At other times, you can deal with it directly. But I think the main thing is to try to, instead of engaging the person who is delivering the insults or who's delivering the sneer pressure, I think the best thing to do is to try and target their audience. You've got to remember, the new atheists aren't trying to convert evangelicals. They're trying to convert the nuns, the people in the middle, the people who either attend church out of a sense of duty, rarely, you know, on holidays and weddings and funerals, or the people who, you know, attend church out of a sense of duty maybe a little bit more often but don't take it terribly seriously. That's the target audience. Now, evangelicals and new atheists are after the same group. And so I think instead of trying to target all our arguments to win, say, for example, Richard Dawkins over, what we need to remember is we're trying to aim at this group in the middle. That's the target audience. And try to present arguments to these people that will inoculate them against some of this sneer pressure. And we'll try and show, no, look, if you're going to think about these big questions, you have to think about them in a substantial way.
Another bunch of good insights there, Graham. Now, you may have already answered this two-pronged question and the things you've been saying, but what do you think is the biggest strength of the New Atheist movement and maybe its biggest weakness?
I think its greatest strength, I think, like I've already said, I think it is its ability to it understands the internet, it understands modern communications, and I think along with that, what I haven't mentioned yet is for the first time, I think the internet has provided a place where atheists can get together. Before that, you can make jokes, you belong to an atheist society. What do you guys do? Not meet and not worship? Or, how many people are there in your, not church? 20, 30 years ago, you'd see these sort of snide comments made about atheist groups. Whereas instead of humanists being a rather small committed group of atheists, all of a sudden this is a very large, popular, vibrant movement. In many cases, very well educated, technologically literate people. And the internet has provided a place where the atheists can have a sense of identity and can have a sense of purpose and a sense of mission, and can even try to get involved politically. So there's some attempt now to try and provide an atheist movement vote with elections coming up next year in America and Britain. So there's a sense there in which a sense of identity has been given to people who want to walk away from religion, maybe who want to walk away from evangelicalism or Catholicism or whatever it is they're reacting against. And that sense of identity is very difficult to deal with. You're not just dealing with arguments when you deal with identity. You've got to try and work out, why have people moved to this particular group of friends? And in many cases, it's because they genuinely are atheists and they believe that, it's genuinely important. But I think the number of ex-evangelicals in there, in the New Atheist movement, even ex-apologists, people who call themselves ex-apologists, by which they simply, really that's usually people who have maybe not studied in enough depth, have thought that there's very simple answers, one-line answers that prove Christianity is true. And the second one, they find out that there's no simple snap answer, that they give up on the faith. So for people who are disillusioned with evangelicalism, the New Atheists provide a stronghold. In terms of its weaknesses, I think its weaknesses has reached its saturation point. I think that really it's not going to be able to grow much more. And if you do scan through New Atheist blogs, there does seem to be an awareness of this, is that, right, we've reached the limits of how much we can grow. Everybody who's going to join is joined. Some people might replace members who have left. We knew that we were never going to be dominant. We knew we were never going to, take over atheism as a whole or secularism as a whole because we're so vociferous. So the question is, what do we do now? How do we use this energy and this strength and this identity? How do we use this to influence people? There seems to be a little bit of a problem now. They have to decide what to do. And I think you see this in what do we do next? I see you see tensions now over, for example, feminism within the New Atheist movement. How feminist should we be? They want to attack evangelicals and fundamentalists on sex, on our sexual ethics. I think they see that as an area where they can win sympathy against evangelicalism and conservative Christians. But this has led to a very, very, very bitter schism within the movement. And if you look at P.Z. Myers and some of the statements that he has made, if you look at some of the accusations that are floating around about New Atheist speakers, if you think your church split was bad, have a look at what's happening in the atheist movement on these issues. It's a nasty affair. And I think that is probably their biggest weakness at the minute, is that they're not too sure what to do next. And there seems to be an awful lot of anger generating on both sides over the issue of feminism. One side saying that people like Richard Dawkins don't take feminism seriously enough, and people who are on Richard Dawkins' side thinking this is a horrendous insult. And I don't think there's much the church can do there, and I think it would be wrong for the church to jump in to try and exploit that. I think you let that play itself out and see what happens next. But there is a significant weakness there.
Yeah, good stuff there, Graham. Now, you mentioned how your book kind of brings things around to the centrality of Christ after you address the new atheist arguments. Can you talk about how you do that? And would this be a book that's appropriate to give to unbelievers and as maybe an evangelistic tool?
Yes, yeah, that's largely why it was written. I don't see a divide between apologetics and evangelism. Whenever you present the gospel to anybody, whenever anybody becomes a Christian, they make a judgment. They say, this gospel describes me. You know, it describes what I need as a person. It describes who I am. It describes my faults. It describes my failures. It describes my weaknesses. And that's a judgment. And I've heard one or two people say, you know, it's a book of apologetics with an evangelistic address at the end. And it's not really. It's a book that you could almost read backwards, because at the end, what I really am saying is, you hear this call of the gospel, you know, that you are a sinner in need of redemption, that you've fallen away from God. I ask people to take this word sin much more seriously. I ask people to think about, well, what would it mean to follow God, to follow Jesus? I mean, is this just a matter of church attendance or religious duty? And again, I present the gospel there that people need to give themselves, you know, personally to God through Christ because of what Jesus has done for them. And what I'm saying to people is, okay, you hear this call of the gospel, you've got to make a judgment now. Is this true, or do you believe this? How do you explain this call that you're experiencing? Can you just dismiss it? And the second that people begin to assess that, they do get into bigger questions along the lines of, can the Gospels be trusted? Did Jesus really rise from the dead? Is there really a God? Is there really a source of all moral authority in this universe? And as you begin to expand out to judge this call, you can get into these bigger apologetic issues. Not everybody does, but many do. And so the book, the whole book is really aimed in at this one point where you're saying to people, well, look, here's the call of the gospel. Here's what Jesus is saying to you. He's saying that he needed to die and rise again for you. He's saying that here's the what's missing in your life in terms of what you need, your spiritual needs. But you don't just have spiritual needs. There's something spiritually flawed. There's something morally flawed. There's something here that needs atonement. There's something here that needs redeemed. And you've got to judge, is that true? Is that true of me? But you're not just approaching this in terms of your subjective feelings. You're bringing in, well, you know, does this gospel make sense of the world around me? For example, this gospel says there is a God. Well, does that claim make sense of the world around me? It says that Jesus died and rose again. Does that make sense of the historical record? And so as you begin to try to explain the call of the gospel, I think you're brought into you've got to deal with these wider issues. And the whole book is trying to push people to the place where they say, well, this is true. You know, what this gospel says is true, and therefore that demands some sort of response from me. I have to, you know, this is a case of, I have to commit myself wholeheartedly, and I have to repent completely, and I have to turn to Christ and trust him totally. But to me, that's not divorced from rationality at all. That's a judgment. And so I'm trying to persuade people that this is a rational judgment to make. And a personal one, and an emotional one, and everything else, but the rational is not divorced from that. And so the book is really aimed in around Christ. It's centered in on Christ, and you know, I'm glad you noticed that, because I mean, a lot of people haven't really picked up on that. That's really what the book is. The book is about the gospel, and it's trying to push people in on that point.
Well, very good, Graham. As we wrap up, would you mind pointing our listeners to where they can find more of your resources online?
Okay, so if you go to www.saintsandskeptics.org, and that's skeptics with a C, although I'm told that sometimes the K will get you there, but it's www.saintsandskeptics.org. And you will find the Saints and Skeptics website. There's a bit about my book there. You'll find something about David Glass's book there too. You'll find resources from a range of Northern Irish writers our own little group. And that's where you'll find out more about me and what I do and what David Glass and Mark McCartney and Peter Morrow, what we do in Ireland to try and promote the gospel and from some of the critiques that it faces from secularism.
Well, Graham, thanks so much for taking the time to do the interview. It's been great.
Thank you very much, Brian. It's been great to speak to you.
I have been speaking with Graham Veal, author of New Atheism, or Survival Guide, and co-founder and writer at the blog Saints and Skeptics at saintsandskeptics.org. Links to Graham's book and website can be found at today's blog post at Apologetics 315. If you've enjoyed the interview, please share it with a friend via Facebook or Twitter. You can also leave a review on iTunes, which also helps us to promote the podcast by encouraging others to listen. You can find us on Facebook, Apologetics 315, and on Twitter at Apologetics 315. There you'll find links to a lot of great resources, as well as great deals on discounted apologetics books on Kindle. Please help us get the word out about good apologetics resources. I want to remind those who'd like to support Apologetics 315 that you can do so by using our Amazon affiliate links located at the right-hand side of apologetics315.com. When you do your normal shopping from Amazon, using those links allows a small portion of your purchase to support what we're doing, and it only costs you a click. Those links can also be bookmarked for ease of use whenever you shop online. We continue to transcribe these interviews with help of volunteer transcribers, and if you'd like to help with more, just email me at interviews@apologetics315.com. If you have suggestions for the interviews, you can also email me there. This is Brian Auden, and thanks again for listening.